This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Deborah Stevenson about cultural policy beyond the economy, work, value, and the social. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to be joining you.
This is a great book. I think it's a really important book. It's one of those books that I think kind of brings together a field and sets a bit of an agenda in terms of thinking about cultural policy. And I suppose one of the sort of starting points for the book might be something like, what are we actually talking about? So what actually is cultural policy?
Ah, dear. Well, you know, definitions may be boring, but they are very important, not just for, you know, for all of us, not just researchers, but for policymakers. And a straightforward way to understand cultural policy, I guess, is that, you know, it's the policies that governments of all levels make with respect to culture. But of course, it's actually much more complex than this. And here we're right, you know, we sort of land right in the heart of definitional imposition and slippage. And at the centre of this, and I think we always come back to it, is the what is culture question. And I've talked about in the book and elsewhere, and others have as well, that understandings of culture as a way of life, which have become quite dominant, are far too broad for the purposes of policy, but equally it's undesirable to constrain the focus of cultural policy to just being about art with a capital A. So a cultural policy should not be an arts policy, but equally it cannot be a policy for everything, I think, is, you know, where we sort of land. But that's, you know, there isn't one right answer, for instance, to what cultural policy is. But,
I was going to say, you grapple with that problem throughout the book, actually, in terms of the boundaries of, like, what is art, what isn't, the boundaries of, you know, which particular policies count for cultural purposes. And I guess one of the questions that I'm slightly intrigued by is a sense of, why did you write this book, particularly in the context of cultural policy that seems increasingly intertwined with the idea of economic policy? So what was the sort of inspiration to write this book about this kind of contested area that is cultural policy?
Well, it was exactly that, pushing back against what I see as the incursion of the discourses and logics of economics into all areas of cultural policy, as you know, and the ways in which we understand and appreciate culture has really been at the centre of my work from the outset. So in many ways, this book is really just a continuation of that concern, but context is important here, we have to admit that it's been a losing battle. You know, the grip of economics, particularly via the language of the creative industries, has become vice-like. And we're in a context where governments see culture as an economic sector, full stop. They expect it to contribute to the broader economy and to be self-sufficient. And if it's not self-sufficient, then organisations need to be generating income from a range of sources, patronage, philanthropy, you know, on-site retail outlets, etc. So, and so the governments and government policy is, you know, right at the centre of legitimating the notion of the creative industries. And my concern, as I said, it's a continuation of a career that's been focused on this, but a significant outcome is that the social content and determinations of culture and its value are largely reduced or explained in terms of the contributions they make to the economy. And I, you know, statement of ideology, I guess, but I think that's regrettable. So I felt there was a need to reflect on some of these issues and processes, and as part of that, to try and foreground some key elements of the social that I think have been lost and which need to be considered. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
I mean, part of the way you do that pushback, that sort of offering of a critique and alternative, is to introduce a theoretical framework that you draw on, I guess, a kind of debate between some key thinkers, Bourdieu and Becker, but you also try and bring in the work of Jürgen Habermas as well. And I suppose I can kind of distill that theoretical project into a question about this idea of the art world complex. And I wonder if you could kind of introduce that idea and say why it's sort of important to the book, how it, you know, maybe moves us beyond particular debates in cultural policy and offers an alternative to that kind of economic framework.
Well, what I think is particularly useful in the work of Becker is his argument that art worlds are multiple and comprised of competing interests, competing participants. And so, you know, we have the producers, we have governments, we have consumers, we have curators, we have artists. And Becker was interested in the ways in which these institutions and people and practices acted as kind of gatekeepers of the art, of their particular art world. Now, being a gatekeeper, of course, means having the power to determine what is and is not accepted as art. But also determining where the parameters of a particular art world are. So it raises questions for me about networks and connections with other art worlds we're talking about particular forms of power, and artists are just one form of, in that complex. But it just made it possible for me to see art and culture and cultural policy as being formed and operating within a complex of art worlds, you know, part of a process. And it opens up a space then for talking about the dynamics of art worlds, including where the economy fits and the relationship with the economy. And here I think I talk about Bourdieu's work on the dynamics of the field being important and the forms of capital and structures of power that shape it are also important. And I just think that a notion like the art world complex just makes it possible to kind of engage with those different sets of ideas without kind of falling into the Bourdieu's cultural fields camp or the Becker art world camp. But it just sort of, I guess, makes it possible to be a bit of a Bowerbird and sort of pull out the threads and the ideas from these different perspectives that are really useful, and make it possible, you know, that a flexible way to think about micro and macro forms of power, as well as understanding sort of social relations and how they shape what happens both within a particular art world, as well as the relationships with other art worlds, and the economy is just one set of influential interests and tensions and intersections that need to be engaged with.
I mean, within that art world complex, one of the things that's really important, and you've sort of alluded to this already, is how we draw kind of boundaries and ultimately how hierarchies are constructed, maintained and challenged. And one of the things that's important with the art world complex idea and with your attempt to kind of steer a course between a very broad and a very narrow definition of culture is this sense of cultural hierarchies changing. And partially this is to do with the influence of things like the creative industries framework, but also it's to do with the way that, you know, we've seen some quite radical changes in terms of patterns of consumption and patterns of engagement because of the pandemic. And to sort of distill that into a useful question for you, I'm interested in the way that cultural hierarchies are important to cultural policy and how they might be changing as well.
Ah, yes. Well, cultural hierarchies are both changing and staying the same, I think. I think that if we think about the work of Bourdieu on cultural hierarchies and their connection to class, then it's very hard to argue that the hierarchies he identifies are anything other than resilient, even in the face of being positioned as part of the creative industries. And the strong expectations that we talked about before, that the traditional arts will engage with the markets and raise external income, et cetera, et cetera. The social and political status of these cultural forms is remarkably resilient. And I think there's a strong view, within that the forms of art that require and maybe deserve the support of government are those historically associated with excellence, those that are in the dominant cultural hierarchy. And I think those views continue. I think they linger. And that gets played out practically with funding bodies and their priorities. So there's certainly a challenging and reconfiguring of the art cultural nexus and hierarchies at work, and has been for some time, because of marketization discourses. But the cultural hierarchies are resilient, and I think that the key there, we go back to class. I mean, I think that it's very hard to move too far away from talking about class when you think about these cultural hierarchies. And with respect to the pandemic, I mean, we've had some time to reflect on that now, haven't we? I still think it's unclear the effect on cultural hierarchies. Now, we all know that the cultural institutions, organisations, cultural workers were absolutely smashed during the pandemic, but they have recovered remarkably quickly in many cases. And there's, sort of strong evidence, at least coming out of Australia, that demand for the products of culture are elastic, even though we're in a period of relatively high inflation and there's, sort of demands to cut back on expenditure. There's no sign that those areas are really being hit. So I think that there's we've got a way to go there in thinking about how that's going to play out. I mean, the pandemic did reveal the structural weaknesses of the sector, and we know what they are: the insecure nature of work, key social and cultural fault lines of inequality. But there's little indication that any of those have really changed as a result of being noticed. And I think that that's that is important. But one thing I would just say in that context, though, it is interesting that the Australian government has a new cultural policy out called Revive, and it makes a point of recognising that artists are workers, artists are cultural work, and cultural workers should have career structures that are long-term and sustainable, and pathways, vocational pathways, fair remuneration. And I think some of that has come directly out of the pandemic and the experiences of art, of the sector in the pandemic. So I think that that's an important shift. But we also know that most people operate outside vocational pathways and frameworks where you can talk about industry standards. Most artists, you know, are operating on their own in their studios and not part of a kind of recognisable industrial structure. So, yeah, it's I think we've still got a lot of thinking and observing to do with respect to the pandemic. But one of the things I think I said in the book was that there was a lot of talk at the time, you know, immediately that the pandemic was going to change a lot of things, and it gave us opportunities to really reflect on the sector. And I think I said, you know, I fear that what might happen is that very soon we end up back where we were. And I do think that to a large extent that's happened.
One of the things within that is this question about funding. And you've again, you know, sort of touched on that a couple of ways. In some ways, you know, public funding is a kind of central issue or point of discussion for cultural policy researchers, but also it shapes, you know, everything from whether the arts have an industrial strategy, how, you know, a sector responds to a shock like a pandemic, how particular ideas come to the fore or others are marginalised. And I'm interested really in a concept you introduce in the middle of the book and you kind of try and grapple with, which is this idea of cultural value. And I'm intrigued to hear, I suppose, why cultural value is something you wanted to write about and where it relates to things like the public funding of culture.
Yeah, well, I think that cultural value, I think, is an incredibly difficult concept to nail down, and one of the reasons why I guess I was thinking about it initially is that in so many ways the language of value has become indistinguishable from a lot of the language of economics. So, you know, in the same way as the goals that are pursued through cultural policy are increasingly economic goals. But, you know, I think that, so I do think that that's, you know, that's a central part of the problem, and it's and that notion of value is very influential within cultural policy, and at least the discourses of cultural policy. But there are other ways of thinking about cultural value, and there's been a lot of work done, particularly in the UK, and you know, I know you've been involved in some of that work. We're trying to think through what the, you know, how we should understand cultural value, and how do we sort of pull it away from that sort of dominant economic paradigm. And then you get into grappling with intangibles, really, such as intrinsic value and the idea that excellent art will somehow commend itself, which is always what you bump up against when you're thinking about, you know, the intrinsic value of a work of art. And you know, and these sort of, these are difficult for sociology to grapple with, of course, because you sort of move into different sort of explanatory frameworks. But there can be no doubt that there is something intrinsically valuable and affecting about certain forms of art and culture. You know, the sort of how does it make you feel question, I guess. And some creative works can make the viewer or consumer feel a great deal. They can feel wonder, they can feel contemplation, anger, sorrow, and so on. We know that. But if we follow much of Bourdieu's writing, then we also know that the knowledge and the vocabulary necessary to appreciate and recognize art as art is acquired through a combination of class and education. So you're kind of constantly in this tension between these, you know, the recognition of what art is, but the social, the kind of social framing of that recognition, and the language, you know, the language for talking about a work of art and its value, are acquired through class position and education. So, you know, I think these are some of the problems, and there are, you know, you could argue that that's too totalizing a perspective, but I think it, you know, it's a complex task. I don't have the answer to it, but.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I mean, you develop that point in quite a bit of detail in one of the later chapters of the book, and this might be a good moment to sort of drill down a bit into that. So one of the things you kind of grapple with is the way that, as you've talked about there, you know, appreciation or the language of art and culture is marked by significant inequalities, but also even the kind of who gets to be an artist is marked by significant inequalities. And I guess the book tries to say these inequalities are a problem, but also there are maybe alternatives, and, you know, sort of critical practices that can challenge these inequalities. So what are some of the inequalities of cultural consumption and production? And what are some of the things you suggest in the book as possible alternatives?
I'm a sociologist, so the inequalities that I'm most interested in are those that are that relate to this, you know, class, gender, ethnicity, you know, to name but three, of course. So they're the, you know, just structural inequalities, and I also was just sort of going on to say that location is another source of inequality that I think I'm interested that I am interested in with respect to cultural consumption and production, and I was just going to give the example of Sydney, which is, you know, there are vast inequities between the in the provision of and resourcing of culture in the affluent eastern suburbs compared with that occurs in the western suburbs. And the bulk of government support for the arts goes to the east. The major cultural institutions are located in the east, as well as the most of the arts educational facilities, publicly funded ones. So location in that, you know, in here kind of maps with class and ethnicity. But if we take a broader view, then we've got, you know, big differences in cultural between cultural provision in the cities and that of rural and regional areas. So class is part of the story here, but only part. So I think that these are the forms of inequality that I am most interested in. And there's some of these differences were things that emerged in the Australian Cultural Fields Project that I was part of, and we found that there were notable differences in the cultural consumption patterns of women and men, for instance, as well as significant class differences. But I think the challenge from a cultural policy, for cultural policy, is how do you calibrate cultural policy to first acknowledge and then seek to address some of these inequalities? And I think that that's a, I think that's a big challenge. And I don't think that there are very many examples of where cultural policy has really attempted to do that.
Yeah, I guess the examples are basically things that are not cultural policy in the kind of formal funded, state-supported sense. So, you know, you talk in the book about things like socially engaged practice and community arts, which have had a long, you know, almost sort of struggle to be seen as legitimate ways of doing art and culture as compared with, you know, say more traditional things about, you know, putting on plays or exhibitions in galleries. And intriguingly, and again, this is sort of linked to the point about geography and place, you also talk about artist-run initiatives. So are any of these kind of alternatives, I suppose, kind of working in the context of inequalities?
Well, I think it's, community arts, as you say, is kind of a long history. And I think it's probably one of the very few cultural policy programs that was developed explicitly to try and address social inequality in some way by focusing on disadvantaged communities. But, the demise of community arts, actually interesting in the Australian context, in particular, and a lot of what happens in Australia, you can track the same trends elsewhere, and particularly in the UK. But the demise of community arts was absolutely accompanied by the rise of the discourses and objectives of the creative industries, and it was the community arts program of the Australia Council, which was instrumental in introducing notions of the cultural economy and cultural planning in particular into the Australian context. So it may not have been its objective, but it is possible to pinpoint the moment that the discourses and expectations of cultural policy shifted away from social disadvantage and community arts to the cultural economy and active engagement with the cultural economy. So I think that relationship is really interesting, and there has been some interesting work done tracking it. But socially engaged practice, and they're older than we like to imagine, of course, and community arts initiatives, I think they're important, but they can be definitely be points of resistance. But how successful they can be, I mean, it really depends on their relationship to the state and to funding bodies, and I don't think that's a straightforward relationship. These are very much part of the art world complex that I was talking about. There are lots of initiatives where it has been governments at different levels that have been the drivers of what we might know as an artist-run initiative. So I think it's unclear. I think that there is definitely a lot to be noted and in terms of a point of resistance. But I do think there are also questions about, you know, who gets to participate in these initiatives and collectives, and what social class do people engaged in these practices and initiatives belong to. It would be interesting to know if someone's done that research. Maybe you know, Dave, or maybe you've done it. But, I do think that there are questions of class there. And the relationship between classes, the class of the artist and the practitioner and the class of the community that is being engaged with. So I think that definitely areas we need to know a lot more about, definitely areas that have a lot of promise. But when I talk, as I did a few years ago, to the head of a major government arts policy body, and that person is talking about artist-run initiatives as being sort of where attention needs to focus, the attention of governments need to focus in terms of cultural policy and the development of culture in the state, then we're not really talking about resistance, are we?
I mean, it's interesting because that has animated some really nice and sort of intriguing Danish work. There's quite a bit of work in Britain on that precise question of that sort of, you know, co-option and resistance. I guess if there maybe practical examples of contested alternatives, one of the things the book does is maybe talk through some, I don't know whether I'd call them like ideological, theoretical, in some cases kind of methodological alternatives, which is the idea of culture being bound up with possibly kind of positive impacts on well-being, and then culture being part of a broader sustainable development agenda, whether in, you know, sort of Australia, the UK, or in other parts of the world. And again, I suppose I've got the same question of to what extent are frameworks, ideologies, discourses of things like well-being and sustainable development alternatives, or, you know, are they still at risk of being captured by that economic way of thinking about culture?
Oh, I think they're absolutely captured by it. I think, well, I mean, the argument that I run is that that well-being and the like of are proxies for the social, and in much cultural policy and planning, and that rather than directly address the social and the social conditions within which art and culture are made and consumed and valued, these proxies are used as a sort of, you know, instead of actually doing that really hard work of engaging, and quite often the proxies are, you know, there are measures, there are tools, there are indicators that are quantifiable and rankable, if that's a word. So what concerns me is that not only do they, you know, strip the social of its messy content and sort of obscure the causes of inequality and privilege, for instance, but they are also frequently underpinned by economic assumptions, and they often highlight individual responsibility, for example, and really don't grapple with the social, and even though I think governments often embrace these proxies for the best of reasons, in fact, it's often I think, you know, I correct me if I'm wrong, but it's often left wing governments that and political parties that are most attracted to these kinds of policy approaches, in part because they do want to deal with the social, but I think they're very thin, and I don't think they really take us very far away from the sort of economic drivers that are at the core of what we need to address within cultural policy, unfortunately.
The final sort of substantive issue the book grapples with before we wrap up and think about cultural policy futures is, what about the actual workers, you know, the artists, the musicians, the designers, you know, the directors, writers, etc. Where do they figure in all of this? And I guess, you know, part of what the book's project is to try and make sure that they play an important and kind of central role, but at the same time, you're trying to highlight some of the problems and issues of how cultural work is organised. And again, you know, you've mentioned them at a couple of points over our conversation. So where does cultural work figure in the book's analysis?
Well, cultural work is to a large extent, and this is one thing that is possibly shifting. So I gave the example of the latest Australian cultural policy. But cultural work has been one of the big silences of cultural policy. And I guess there are probably a number of reasons for this, but an important one is that there's just a very strong tradition of not thinking about a lot of cultural production as work. and I sort of spent, as you know, quite a bit of time in the book sort of thinking about some of the ideological and discursive reasons for this. And one is the notion of vocation, which I think is implicit in much thinking about creative work. An artist, you know, almost by definition, is imagined as someone who has some kind of calling that, you know, compels them to create. And there's that strong expectation that's sort of grounded in some of these discourses that artists will work for nothing. They'll work for love or, you know, exposure. And there are also some blurred lines between being a professional and being an amateur, and so much around this notion of income. You know, people identify as a cultural worker, as an artist, as a professional, but they earn almost nothing from that labour. And those kind of boundaries are really, really quite interesting, I think, and I think they're important because I do think they have kind of structured the way we think about a lot of what we now talk about as cultural work, but we still can't get a handle on exactly who this cohort is. You know, it's a very slippery concept, I think. But so there are a lot of contradictions here, and the language of the creative industries positions, you know, artists as often, you know, as not, if not, you know, they're sole traders, they're people, they're small businesses. So it's very, yeah, I think it's a really important area, and was one of the things I wanted to do was just sort of track some of those really pervasive discourses that shape the way artists are imagined within contemporary society.
I mean, the book has like real sort of breadth and depth to it, and hopefully, you know, we've given a sort of flavor of some of the ideas in the book to the listeners. The book, I suppose, all the way through is concerned with the question of what's the future of cultural policy, how do we reimagine cultural policy, but obviously some of this comes in particular in the conclusion. And as a way of wrapping up our conversation, are there ways to kind of think differently about cultural policy? You know, you mentioned almost the sort of failure of the pandemic moment to give us a new blueprint for thinking about culture, thinking about society, the ongoing, you know, as you've just been discussing, tensions about the status of the artist as a worker, grappling with, you know, public funding models and you know, new ways of arguing for the value of art and culture in development and things like this. So I suppose what are your sort of prospects? What do you sort of think in terms of the chances of reimagining cultural policy in society?
Well, I'm probably going to sound a bit pessimistic, I'm afraid. I don't think there's one answer to this question. I think it's about starting points and questions that we need to ask. The first challenge is to question the dominance of the economic, and primarily through creative industries discourses. I don't see any sign that is necessarily happening, but it's critically important. I think we also need to think about linkages between the culture portfolio of government and other portfolio areas, education, important one, workplace relations or industrial relations, another important one, and it's very difficult for that to be initiated within the cultural sector, the cultural portfolio, of course, because it's usually structurally not very powerful. So I think that there are some issues there that need to be addressed. And I was was thinking, actually, I don't know whether I mentioned this in the book or not, but many years ago, David Throsby, well-known cultural economist, asked the question of whether Australia needed a cultural policy. And I was wondering whether it's not a question of whether we need one or whether a cultural policy is needed, particularly, at least beyond, you know, symbolic functions. But the question really is, what can cultural policy reasonably achieve, and how can these concerns be managed across different portfolios and levels of government? And these are really big questions, and, you know, hopefully the book makes a small contribution to grappling with them, but I fear there may be more questions than answers in some of this, unfortunately.
I mean, in terms of that, you know, more questions than answers and grappling with these big questions, what's next in terms of your own work? It strikes me that, as you've just described there, you could easily do a sequel to this book or in fact, probably, you know, two or three follow-ups that deep dive into some of the particular issues that each chapter looks at and, you know, tries to situate the analysis in response to whether it's governments or social responses to the context we find ourselves in. Or are you kind of thinking, actually, cultural policy has sort of had enough of me for a while, and are you thinking about doing something completely different?
Well, I think at the moment I'm quite occupied with two big projects, which both have a bearing on cultural policy. One of them is work that I'm doing with Justin O'Connor and Christiane de Berkeley on UNESCO as a global cultural policy operative. And some of these questions, unsurprisingly, loom large in that project, because we are very interested in where the creative industries fits into a lot of what UNESCO is doing its different policy project processes. So that's a big project, and hopefully some writing will come out of that over the next little while. And the other project is looking at cultural infrastructure, which I think is a really critical area that relates to cultural policy. And it's quite interesting that there's a little bit talking about proxies for the social, as there's some cultural infrastructure policy work that is often a proxy for actual cultural policy. So I think that's interesting. But this is looking at how major cultural infrastructure becomes embedded within communities and how that... when I talk about communities here, I'm talking about cultural communities as well as social communities. So that's another big, both of those projects funded by the Australian Research Council. And again, there will be some writing coming out of that work too. So I think that's probably where my thinking is at the moment, both of them really still focused on cultural policy and exploring in a bit more depth some of the issues that have come up in this book.